Very glad to have our guest of honor here. And let me just tell you on a personal note, I've been waiting 19 years since I've known Cheech to be sitting alongside him so that you would see Cheech and Chong. And to be able to tell you finally, after many years, that the G is silent. But Cheech and I actually have performed together once before in 1992. When we both testified before the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights about the situation facing Latinos on television. And I will have to say, Cheech not only kicked ass, he was probably one of the most prepared speakers that day before the Commission on Civil Rights. Now you remember this.
I don't remember at all.
We completely changed the industry, as you recall.
Oh, well, not that day.
Well, we're here to talk about art, and we had an opening about a week ago for the show Los Angelinos, which is here at LACMA. And there was a palpable sense among a lot of the artists there of just almost disbelief that there were two Chicano art shows at LACMA. Realize the last show, a group show, was in 1975, so there was a sense that probably within the next 2 or 3 days, there'd be a major earthquake.
I was worried when the sound went off, man.
That was it. That's a good issue, though. I wonder if we can start, Cheech. You know, obviously, you heard the audience laughing when there was a clip from one of your classic American films. There may be a certain understanding of you. I tried, the museum refused to advocate promote the show as Cheech and Chong because they thought it might send the wrong message. My request for a bong and for smoke to be coming out also turned down. The museum claimed the budgeting was an issue. So, you know, given that image, what was it like for you to begin actually becoming known as a collector? How did that process start?
Well, you know, when I first started the process, when I first started being involved with museums, and it was the start of the Chicano Visions, which was almost seven years ago, the process was very much further. I've been on this project for 13 years. It was disbelief. It was disbelief and a little bit of resentment, too, because there's people who grew up in the art world, and they were academicians, and they were museum curators and everything. And they're working all their lives in this field trying to get something going. Here comes this doper. And what the hell does he know about anything? You know, a Chicano art or whatever. Well, open the crates and find out. You know, and that's what the experience was. The first time I, because it had been always my theory that there was a school of Chicano art, and here's how I define it. And a lot of contrary opinions, but I said, well, you know what, the proof is in the pudding. One day I'm going to put all these paintings in one room, and you're going to see it. And so that day, when I opened up, they started opening up the crates in San Antonio, the San Antonio Museum, when we opened the show, that was the experience. Like, yeah, Jesus, they're going to have Madonna's Boy Toy, and, you know, the Velvet Bullfighter. And then they start opening up the crates and seeing all this great art, all these great Chicano artists.
So, let's go back a little bit. When did you actually start collecting?
I started collecting seriously Chicano art in the mid-80s, by 85. Mm-hmm. But my background as a collector goes back to since I was born. I was always a collector of something, you know, like baseball cards or marbles or magical colors, or, you know, and I just had this mania for kind of getting things and then getting the whole set, you know, and classifying and quantifying.
But, you know, a lot of collectors, they're going to gallery shows, they're acquiring work, but it's usually some point a little bit later when you realize, man, I'm a collector. When was that moment?
When I had to have storage. People see the show, they go, man, you must have the biggest house in the world. I don't get to see all this art all the time, you know. So, like, you know, you start collecting, what I did, start collecting Chicano art because you want something that hangs over the couch. You know, and your criterion just has to be 4x5. Green would be nice. Yeah, a green couch. Chicano's got any green. Well, you know, my education arc was way back. I was in second grade. I was going to Trinity Street School on 36th of Santa Pedro, where I grew up right downtown. And we had gone to the Great Central Market, the Grand Central Market, and the teacher asked us to draw our impressions of what we saw. And the thing that stood out to me was these giant squashes. They were bigger than all the kids. They were giant, you know. So it was a pastel. She was on it right from the start. Squash, man. It was a little stick figure kid, me. And the teacher looked at us and said, well, you'll never be an artist. Okay. But I loved art. I grew up Catholic in a Catholic church, and that's your
first time Catholic church.
I did. It seemed like I did. I was an altar boy, choir boy, all those things. And you see all the art on the walls and in the ceilings and stuff. And then one day it went off in my head that, well, somebody actually got up on a ladder and painted that. Wow, that's hard. And then I started seeing other kids. So at a very early age, I started self-educating myself in art. I think I was around 11 or 12. I used to go to the library and take out all the art books just to see what it was. Well, okay, that's Picasso. That's what he looks like. Okay, that's Cezanne. Okay, you know, that's Miro. And I did this because I wanted to be sophisticated. I wanted to increase my area of knowledge, and I wanted to be able to walk into a cocktail party in Manhattan one time and go, oh, that's a nice Chagall. You know, like that was going to happen, you know? But eventually it did, you know? So, yeah.
You have to explain that you got such aspirations as a kid in East LA.
You know, I was very fortunate in that I had a group of cousins. There was four of us, and then we were all academics. And then we came from blue-collar families. My father was a policeman, and the other fathers were upholsterers and worked for the railroad. But just my generation of cousins were very smart. I mean, and we competed against each other academically. They all got, I was the runt of the litter. I mean, you know, it was the my other cousins, they got scholarships everywhere they went. The University of the SC, State Scholars, University of Tokyo, Harvard. I was a cousin who was the first PhD graduate in Chicago Studies from Harvard. And I was always struggling to keep up. And so part of our curriculum was, you know, Catholic education, one of the Catholic schools. It was, it was art and education, and we were exposed to art, we were exposed to the classics. And so we would, okay, well, you don't know this, well, then you're done. Well, you better not be done. No. Okay, I got it, you know. And so I started developing my eye very early. And the eye is just like anything else, you can develop it. And so when I started knowing what was in the books, and whenever I got a chance with a class or even a part of the class, I used to go to museums and go up and see the paintings in person. It's a whole different experience than seeing paintings in a book. You get to, you know, I can't remember how many times the guards said, "Hey, can't touch that." No, it's fine. There was something about paint that fascinated me. I love the malleability of it. I love how it smears. I love how it just you get shades when you mix it that weren't on the scale before. You know? So I love painting. So that's that was my goal.
When you first started acquiring work, what kind of work were you wanting?
Well, you know, I didn't know. I just started buying art. When you first get money, you buy art. It's like, hey. And this was the early 70s, and I was on the road a lot with Tommy Chong, and I discovered Art Nouveau. Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
and Art Deco, and that was just before everybody else discovered it, and I was on the road, and I started there again. Books, look to books. Okay, that's that. And every town I would pull into when we were on tour, because we were on tour always, I would call up and whip out the yellow pages in the hotel. Okay, do you have this? I'll be right over. And I put together this large Art Nouveau and Art Deco collection and antiques at that point. And then when that got really expensive because the market blew up, I said, I make the money, but not that much money. So I started looking around for something else. And the gap in my knowledge was contemporary art. I didn't know really what was Chicanos in the here in LA on the west side. And that's where I discovered these Chicano paintings. And the thing that struck me when I first saw, and I started seeing them one right after the other, because other people, you know, would, if one artist would introduce me to another artist, reluctantly, you know, he buys that guy painting, he won't buy mine. And so, I started putting this by to paint. But the thing that struck me right away is, these guys are great painters. You know, because I knew what great painting was, because I'd seen it all in my life. And not only did the image and what they were saying resonate with me, this is my cultural background, but it was technically great. You know, it's like discovering musicians that can really, really play. You know, great jazz musicians are not, I saw these guys and women that they were not, I say guys in general, so I don't believe that you can. And so I saw that these guys could really put it on, you know, and they can really, they're spontaneous, and they have command over their technique, and they're not counting, they're like, you know, like this is Miles Davis, John Coltrane, or like, I don't know if that was the visual equivalent for me. So I recognized right away, wow, these guys are starting to be really good. Then my collector mania kicked in, you know, and gratefully, what allowed me to do this is I was employed. Through much of this period, you know, I'm not a billionaire philanthropist. Not that there's anything wrong with billionaire philanthropists, but I couldn't say, you know, send over 2 tons of art. You know? I had to be working in order to collect art. So whenever I worked, I would buy art consistently. Sometimes I remember in one instance I did a movie and got paid in paintings. Because they couldn't afford what I want. Okay, you're gonna make up the difference. I know these paintings that I want, and they're coming up for sale, and you gotta buy them. Yeah, whatever. You know, and that there's a big mural in Mexico, 4 panels, almost like a mural, Mexico, Mexico, by Frank Romero. That was one of the paintings I got when I did a movie.
Wow, what movie was it?
The Mexico Mexico movie. I don't remember. It wasn't about the movie, it was about getting those panels. You know, and so then, you know,
you get your priorities, right?
You know, hey, this is what you know. And then all of a sudden, in the mid-90s to 2000, I was on this Nash Bridges series with Don Johnson. Mm-hmm. I was living in San Francisco. And that was very good because I was employed all the time. And that's when I put the bulk of the collection together. I mean, I had a lot of pieces before that, but now I can afford to spend money all the time. So I started buying in depth for the artists which I did.
Did you also begin buying outside of Los Angeles at that point?
Yeah. I was very, very fortunate in putting this collection together in two ways. One, that at the very beginning of seeing these paintings, I was introduced to the painters of Texas. There was a dealer here named Perez, and she introduced me. She started a small gallery here, and she introduced me to these Tejanos. And, you know, and there was like Cesar Martinez and Alan Hernandez, and I don't know, all these guys. And like, so right at the beginning, and that's what really got me going, hey, there's a Chicano school brewing here, you know, because these guys in San Antonio, which was the other really great center, and L.A., They're not exactly the same, but they're the same a lot, you know? And there's some DNA code going on here. And they didn't really communicate with each other that much. You know, they kind of heard about each other's groups. But they sometimes, I remember the first showing in San Antonio, when we had all the artists could come in, this was the first time any of them met. And so I was like, this is definitely a Chicano school. They're saying something. And it took me a while to figure out exactly how to define what they were saying. You know, because I always theorize that there's this Chicano school of art, because I could see it. the establishment kind of put me down. We don't use school anymore. It's very passe. It's very old school. I don't know if it works for you, but not for me. Okay. You know? And so I said, well, you know, call it what you want, but my definition of a school is where people come together to learn and express a variety of different viewpoints on the same subject and come to a consensus and maybe come to a new understanding of what they were studying. So in that instance, the Chicanos are a university. You know, they're not a school. But what I came to realize, from my point of view, is that what made it a school was that all these artists were depicting the Chicano experience, what it meant to look at the world through Chicano eyes from a myriad of different viewpoints, whether it was historical or sociological or gender-based or religious or abstract and humorous. And when you put all these viewpoints together, you get this whole 360 of it. You get the feeling, you get this sabor of what it is to be Chicano. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at your exhibition, the style, the range of styles is very broad.
Yes.
And there'd be some art stylistically, I don't see how they connect. But it seems that the color palette is very similar.
The color palette is very similar for a lot of those artists in the tropical colors. When they made this shirt, you know? Chicano's not affected. Chicano's not afraid of color. You know, that's always the flame. Some Chicanos get sick of it. Oh, you're so colorful. Can we be so colorful? Only white people have nice teeth. It's kind of the same deal.
You're
generalizing, aren't you? Yeah, I know. I'm color, having great color. Great color is wonderful. It's so life affirming and so full of energy. Every time I walk into the museum, any museum that's been showing the show is like, whenever I can, and I usually come in and do a group of press and TV and radio, whatever I can do to get them in the tent, I usually go to the museum and in the galleries and have lunch there. Because I just love being among the paintings. Color is a definite expression of our color, and the color palette that a lot of these artists use is a definite expression of our culture.
Now, just to go into the show a little bit, what's interesting is, against that backdrop, you have someone like Roberto Gutierrez, great artist. You have two works of his in black and white.
In black and white. But it's a real colorful black and white. Somebody said that to me in the open. They said, that's in black and white. It's really colorful. And I knew exactly what he meant. Yeah, I can dig it.
He was thinking colors as a painter.
He does work in colors, too, but he goes to this period of black and white. Roberto Gutierrez is the chronicler of East L.A. I don't know if you've seen his paintings. If you go to the show, you'll see them. And he was instantly recognizable as East L.A. Any of the scenes, if you've ever been driven through, even, you say, oh, I'm just that. Captures the essence of the feeling of being in that part. He was like many of the impressionists that painted Montmartre. They defined it for their age, and he defines it for his group.
Yeah, I don't know if there's an answer to this question, but because you've obviously been somebody that really studies up on things that are of interest and that you want to pursue. But was there a moment when you went from just buying a bunch of paintings that you liked to realizing you had an agenda, that there was an underlying logic, and that you could begin pursuing that pretty consciously?
Yeah, it's a very distinct moment. It was like around 85, 86, and I'd been collecting for about a year, and I was starting to amass some paintings. And I was in New York doing a movie, and I was living in Tribeca, and I was there for 4 or 5 months doing this movie. And I was, two things happened. I was living and hanging out with a lot of these go-go 80 artists, Julian Schnabel, Keith Harry, David Sally, and they were all there. And we used to get together and party and stuff like that. And I said, wait a minute, these guys got homes in the Hamptons, and they're represented around the world by big galleries, and they've been showing Castle and Basel, and these Chicanos over here that I know, they don't even have a gallery, or some don't have studios, or they're showing in restaurants and coffee shops. There's an inequity. And this case, they're better paintings, but fine. And so there's an inequity here, And then there was the other thing that happened. I was living in Tribeca, and I'd get up in the morning, on the days that I had off, and I'd walk down to the street to get my paper and buy my coffee, and come back and read it. I'd see all these Mexicans around there, a lot. Mm-hmm. And I call my buddy and say, I'm living down in Tribeca, New York, and there's a lot of Mexicans here. And he goes, no, those are Puerto Ricans, they've been there forever. No, these guys are Mexican. And there's a lot of them. And there's something happening here, man. Everywhere I started seeing it, everywhere I went. And I realized that really we were involved in the biggest wave of immigration ever in the history of the country right now, and chiefly from Mexico. That's going to fundamentally change most aspects of American life.
Yeah.
And so when I said, well, you know what? When I get home, I'm going to take my celebrity and see what I can do to give them more exposure so they can get shelf space. It wasn't like I wanted to force Chicano art on them and say, hey, this is art, you got to like it or shut up. What it was just give us, let us get up. Let's get on the walls. You can't love or hate Chicano art unless you see it. And being denied that privilege meant that this whole generation, three generations of artists, could pass into obscurity like that, easy, and be discovered 100 years from now with somebody on earth. He's paying, oh, I found a whole stack of these really colorful paintings. Where the hell did this shit come from? Very easy. It would be very easy for them to be gone. And they go, this is not going to happen. The other thing that struck me right away is, why am I able to buy all the masterpieces of Chicano art now? Why are they available? Why are these 24 by 12 paintings and these masterpieces of every one of these artists in their studio or available or rolled up or behind a couch or something like that? Because no other institution and or collective, but mostly institution, nobody other than had a collection of Chicano art. It wasn't recognized because, you know, there they were. And so I could go to the artists and go, I'm not one of these big philanthropists, I'm a working actor, and I'll buy a lot of paintings from you over a lot of period of time, but you got to cut me a break. And they go, okay. But once they said, oh, it worked, yeah, I could amass this huge collection of these masterpieces that were still out there. And that flabbergasted me that they were still available.
I think it's an amazing moment, almost 25 years ago, yeah, where you have a group of artists who've been working for 20 years, who've gone through the Chicano movement, who have become established and mature artists. And I'm amazed, I mean, not surprised that you notice this, but also what's happening concurrently with the shift in migration. Now Spanish Harlem is Mexican Harlem. Latinos, predominantly Mexican Americans of Mexican descent, are the largest minority group, the largest population in the city. But you're hitting on another aspect, which is been slower to change. We've seen it easier for Latinos to get elected to public office than to work in Hollywood. And we're seeing a situation where this generation of artists have not, by and large, been integrated into permanent collections. What have you been doing over the next 15 years as you work towards the Chicano vision?
Well, also the collection got to be of a certain size. And the people that I knew that were involved in art, well, I had a lot of artist friends. I was married to an artist at the time. I don't recommend it. just some advice from Chief, you know?
Thanks, cheaper to buy the work.
Yeah. Cheaper not to do it in the first place. But
this is your monastery of an album.
Yeah, maybe. Question.
You're talking about celibacy and...
Oh, yeah. I started with this collection. I had a bunch of pieces, you know, and they were kind of, I filled my house as many as I could. And when I started studying, that's when I had storage. Why have art if you have it in storage? You know, that's kind of always back then, but I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. I really, okay, let me see the policy. Okay, that house for me, I don't have more. And
if people are familiar with you as somebody that's an addictive type.
I guess. I think that's what I told to the judge. Anyway, so I started, so my friends asked, well, hey, you should do a show. You should. I know a couple of people in this Monterey Museum, they could put up some stuff, you know. And then my Mexican Chicano genes kicked in, maybe, I don't know. So, you know, like, all right. So, get on it. So, at some point I go, you know what, I got enough works that I can really mount a good show. And they kept arriving more and more every day. So I said, all right, so I had to look around for a way to do that. I very quickly realized you gotta have a sponsor. It's always all very nice and good to come up with this idea, I'm gonna show my art to the museum. And who's gonna pay for the art museum? and so you had to fight two things. First, getting the money from their pocket to your pocket, hard, a long journey over arid country. And then the long-standing tradition of Chicanos to be resistant to have any corporations involved in what they were doing. They're co-opting my vision. It's barbed wire and a cactus, dude. How do they go up there? So I started this. I met a company. I put together the company from San Antonio, and their expertise was doing big interactive museum shows, kid-friendly. And so a bunch of them said, well, we could probably do something. And what we came up with was two-pronged show. One was a traditional painting show, and one was a 5,000-square-foot interactive show on different aspects of Chicano life, anchored by commissioned videos. I went to the Venice Biennale in 1995 or something like that, in Venice, in Italy. And what I was struck by is that most countries sent film, video, very few paintings, very few sculptures, and this new medium, comparatively, was we sent that. And they're very innovative the way they did that. And put them together. So I can do it on these Chicanos, they're filmmakers, and they can, so I can put some show together that way. And it also gave me an entree to have other artists, you know, other kinds of artists, you know, they were painters. And so from that idea to getting together with BBH was the name of the company, and then we started going around to corporate America, showing them our stuff, that stuff, printed up, and you know, spies and all those things. And that process took 4 years. And I went into every boardroom of every major corporation in America, with General Motors, with Nabisco. At one point, the Army was going to do that. Was going to piss everybody off. But they were the largest employers of Chicanos, first of all. It's true. That's all the people who have relatives in the Army, man. And so, you know, I'm like, oh, well, okay, in the Army, I guess I could not get much slack for that. That'll be all right. And so then they fell out, you know, because it's a slog. I mean, you really have to be dedicated, because even if you go into corporate America and you do your little dance, and the guy that's in charge of community relations that has a budget, he loves it, and then when he gets ready to pull the trigger, he quits and goes to another company. And that happens all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the time, you know. And so you got to kind of, okay, sign script right now. Like, time to talk. Be on the phone, get pregnant right now. And that took... That process really was 4 years, and that was all the time going in. It was, and I had to wrap down, man. Finally, in their far-seeing wisdom, the Target stores, Target Corporation, and Hewlett Packard put up the seed money to produce the show, committed to buy the trucks, to buy the cases, to produce the Chicano Now show, and schedule all the museums. They put up the seed money, and it was always from the beginning a very ambitious project. Yeah. It was a 5-year commitment. This would be the 14th museum that the show went to, and with another show that's a 5,000-square-foot interactive show, and to their everlasting good grace, the Target show stores stayed on the tour. Because there was a market there that they wanted to reach, and they thought that this was the hippest way to do it. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that they are going to tell you what to do, and they're going to compromise with, the only thing they ever do is put a little logo right in the corner. That's all. That's all I ever heard from them, ever. And also they commissioned Chicanos to pay paintings for the corporate collection.
You know, you've been talking about how hard this is. I mean, it's reminding me of, you know, you hear... like Clint Eastwood, or somebody talks about it takes years to pull the funding together, and he makes that film. It's striking me that this would never have happened if it hadn't been somebody with your celebrity. That you were more well known than the thing you were trying to advocate.
Absolutely. It would have never have happened. I mean, because This celebrity's got to be more useful for something than just getting a table at the restaurant, you know? And it was really surprising when I went out, because the art world is a very insular world in many ways, and I got kind of Hollywood to it, and a beloved member of the community. And all those factors worked in conjunction, so when we pulled into a town, there was like a combination. They didn't know what to be impressed by. You know, the art, the being, the fact that it was going to be on TV, but usually an art show gets one newspaper right in there. We would get 100.
So how did the show do as it went around the country?
Thanks for asking. we broke attendance records in every single museum that we... result of, first and foremost, because the art drew them. It was great art. And you don't get a repeat business, and you don't get the whole community or the city where you're involved in by just the Latinos showing up. You got to get everybody to come. We were at the Smithsonian for 6 months. We did 975,000 people came to that show. The St. Louis Science Center, thank you very much. St. Louis Science Center, where we showed the show, the second biggest show in the history after Titanic. After Titanic, a huge ass show, man. In Minneapolis, the museum there, Indiana State Museum, all records.
They even know they had a Chicano community up there in Minnesota.
Yeah, they found out real quick. No, the factor, there is one. It goes along with this. The University of Minnesota claims to have the oldest Chicano studies program in the country. And I believe it, actually, because there's some old Chicanos there. Right? I mean, like, and looking around, we're a panelist just like this at a restaurant sometimes. Says, you know, we came here a long time ago, and you know, we worked and everything, and goddamn, it's cold here. Really, that's a diehard Chicano, man. You know, and I go, that's cool. The other aspect of that, the biggest wave of immigration that's ever happened in the history of the country right now, is the thing that differentiates from other waves is that it is in every state. Every single state that you go to has a large, growing, and thriving Latino, primarily Mexican population. You go to Delaware, you go to North Carolina, Mississippi, Rhode Island, even Texas. All those states that heretofore have not had a Latino presence have a giant, and they're not going anywhere. And the other aspect of that is almost 80% of them are under 25. Prime baby-making years. So that population is going to at least quadruple. At least. Not in Mexico's armor, you know. And in every state. What is happening with this wave of immigration now, it is going to fundamentally change every aspect of American life, whether it be financial, which we are the linchpins of this economy, cultural, politically, aesthetically, spiritually. It's going, and it is a good thing. The thing that has made America great is the infusion of new blood.
So why is it important to have Chicano art in museums?
You know,
you're talking about something that's happening. It's going to happen.
No, it's going to happen.
But what is the significance of having, we're perceived as fairly elite institutions, joining Chicano art? How would that matter?
Every museum I went to, the reason we were welcome in, you know, in places we'd never been before, is that they realized that they had a large Latino population and they wanted to connect to that. And how do we do it? Well, it's very simple. You talk to them. And the way you talk to them in your museum, you put pictures of their culture on the wall. And then they realize that you're talking to them.
Pretty complicated.
Very simple. And then they realize, and it engenders this dialogue. They become part of the process. They want to register to vote. They want to bring their kids to the museum on Sunday. They want to support those programs in the school. They want to work that extra 5 hours a week that creates money to go for art education programs everywhere they went.
So these museums, part of what's happening is they're losing their traditional audience base. They need that audience. It justifies the existence, the public money that goes into them, but it also creates box office. But I guess the issue is that the institutions haven't always treated Latinos as a part of the public, as part of what's being served by including it in the exhibition, right?
Yeah. You
know, what I find fascinating about you and why you're able to do this, we were at some event a few years ago, and there were all these 10, 11-year-old kids that were just kind of like hovering around you, and they weren't yours, you know? Let's be clear about that.
They're on their face, it's true.
They wanted to come up to you, and I had one about, my name is Cheech, school bus driver. And I realized, okay, there are all these kids that are now freshmen, sophomores in college that read that in second grade. That are part of the audience that's coming here. That your appeal really is not just to those of us that have foggy memories, but that, you know, as a celebrity, you really seem to have a fairly broad reach. And I guess our time is kind of running near the end, but I wanted to hear. As long as the air conditioning is on. I wanted to end with the discussion of your sense of how do you make sure something gets left behind, that the institutions didn't just benefit in that moment, and then that moment never comes back, but you have some kind of impact on each of these institutions. And what sort of efforts are you doing to kind of have that?
Boy, it is an ongoing effort. We were talking backstage just now about getting your foot in the door. And then you have to get that foot in there and get both feet in the door. And there's put your hands up there. And you all, thank you very much for welcoming us here. Thank you. We're very proud to be here. And that's the process, you know. it's like this old friend of mine, Tony, he's a very successful businessman, you know. And he talks, you know, in order to succeed in business, you got to learn how to eat shit until it tastes like caviar. Stay with me, you know, because it's an ongoing battle. But what you do is you set up programs, and I'm a little blind involved, you set up programs to involve the community. Once they realize that you're talking to them, then they'll listen. You know, they go, oh, we're going to persecute, we're going to sell the Mexicans back to Mexico, blah, 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 because they don't pay taxes. They love to pay taxes. They would love to pay taxes. Just give them a chance, you know. They'd be like, don't pay taxes up their ass, man. You know, they already pay taxes already, but they don't get no benefits from them, you know. But they would love to be part of it. The reason I survived for so long is I'm a typical chick. I don't act at three jobs all the time. I gotta entertain those kids from moon to tomb, man. You know, like, and it's great. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But what I'm involved in now is going from every city that I think is a fertile ground and starting Latino support groups there, so that the local backers of whatever Latino presence you want to have, they raise money, because we're going to have to do it, folks, just like everybody else. We buy our way in. It's the American way. And it works. You know what? The people that put up the money for this institution and all these buildings there get to say what goes in those buildings, because they put up the money. And it works in every single museum exactly the same way. We got money. They keep saying we got money. And now we're going to put that group together. So just, okay, we shall be the benefactors of this culture, because we are part of the culture. This institution, long history of being shut out of this institution. We are involved in a fundamental change of that attitude right now, with just a mirror of the wave of immigration under the leadership of Michael Dell, who is, I think, truly enlightened. This
program is shifting around, and we'll say shifting around. We're in the Los Angeles Museum of Art, County Museum of Art here in the city, in the state of California. It's funny, Schwarzenegger is the only guy that pronounces it correctly. This is the weirdest thing that, you know? But,
California.
Cool, man. Homeboy, you know? Give that Mexican schnitzel, that real good. Peter Schnitzel, that's what I want, Peter Schnitzel. But you know, but that's the process that's going on right now. It's okay, we have to be involved just like everybody else traditionally has been involved. We have just as many professionals. Just with the mayor of the city is a Chicano, and many other places. And okay, now we have to step up because there's no history of Latino or Chicano philanthropy. It's time. And so, but the time, what it takes is organization. And so, when you walk into the museum here, you see this big wall with chiseled names. And every one of those letters costs thousands of dollars. Because they get them, I want my name up there. You know, I want to be, you know, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren. Oh yeah, people feel it. You know, it's like the Vietnam Memorial. Yeah. You know, it means that much. And so, you know, the reason I put this show together was to send out our most sensitive and far-seeing ambassadors, who are the artists, that see things coming a long way. You know, these are our cultural ambassadors. That's why this show and the show that went to various places in the United States is our ambassadorial, is that a word? Ambassadorial. Entree into the country. You know, you send out, it's a gift. It's a gift you send, and it was well received, no matter where they wanted it. And you have to keep following up. You have to involve people in the process. You know, I mean, before, the encouragement was to hide in the shadows. You're being encouraged to hide in the shadows because you're being persecuted. You know, don't say where you're from, don't say you have this, or don't say that. But don't involve yourself in the process. The opposite is true now. Involve yourself in the process.
I'd like to conclude by leaving a few thoughts here about Cheech and where he's going to take us. And just pointing out that in 1971, Cheech, or 1972, Cheech had the largest selling comedy album of all time. In 1978, he had the highest grossing film comedy of all time. As a collector, he has broken attendance records at probably a dozen museums. And now he's talking about putting his name on a building here. Next to the Baroque Contemporary Museum, I would expect him to have a Chicano art museum. But I just want to emphasize what he's saying in terms of having an institutional impact, about leaving things behind. That become part of the structure of our society. And I want to thank him for the efforts that he's done. In fact, that we do have two Chicano art shows here at LACMA through the summer. And I strongly encourage you to go see both of them and to think about everything that is missing in between these